Mundial. Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to those who joined us yesterday for a public lecture. Welcome to those who are joining us this morning for the first time. I welcome you to the 7th McGill Global Food Security Conference. I hope that and wish us all a great day sharing reflections, knowledge, lots of information about food security. We have put together a program that we are really hoping will be very interesting for you, stimulating for your thoughts, for your work. We have colleagues and delegations from many different countries. The program incorporates presentations about food security related issues in Canada, in Northern Canada, in other provinces of Canada besides Quebec. We have presentations from Guatemala, from Colombia, from the Caribbean community, from Ghana, Kenya, India. Presentations by graduate students sharing their work with us. Research conducted in Ethiopia, in Panama. Posters showing the work of our students and students at other universities in Haiti, in China, in British Columbia, in Ecuador. This conference promised to be a very enriching, nourishing event for all of us. So welcome to all of you. It's my pleasure to start the program of the conference this morning, introducing to you Dean Chandra Matramutu. Dean Matramutu will deliver this morning the keynote address to open this day of debates and sharing. Professor Chandra Matramutu is Dean of the Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences at McGill University. He is an Associate Vice Principal at our university, a member of the Senior Academic Leadership Team of McGill University, and a James McGill Professor in the Department of Bioresource Engineering. He has been the driving force behind the creation of the McGill Institute for Global Food Security, as well as the McGill Bray Center for Water Resources Management. He served as the founding director of the Bray Center for a 7-year period. Professor Matramutu obtained his bachelor's degree, master in science, and PhD degrees in agricultural engineering at McGill, and has also developed his academic career in this university as a professor in irrigation and drainage engineering, rising rapidly through the academic ranks. He is a registered professional engineer and a member of the Ordre des Ingénieurs du Québec. Professor Matramutu is an internationally respected expert in water table management, irrigation, drainage, water quality, watershed management, land reclamation, agricultural research, and international agricultural development. I could continue with his achievements, and we are very happy to have him here. And thank you very much, Chandra, for being with us.
Thanks. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Hugo, for your very kind remarks. Colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure for me to deliver these remarks today on the opening of our conference this morning to talk about breaking the barriers to food and water insecurity. If we think about some of the drivers that are affecting water and food security today, we first of all think about the world population that is expected to grow to around 9 billion people by the year 2050. And as we heard from Stephen McGuirk last night, this growth in population will increase the demand for food, and also because of the growth of the urban class as well, a change in dietary patterns will require an increased consumption of different types of food products than we have traditionally produced in many of the countries where this growth is taking place. The FAO predicts that food production will have to increase significantly to be able to meet those demands for food just in Asia and the Pacific alone, there will need to be a 77%, nearly 80% increase in food production to meet the demands of one of the largest growing segments of the population around the world within Asia and the Pacific. When we think about water, one in three people on every continent is affected by water scarcity. Water scarcity is a reality in many parts of the world. Countries in the Sahelian zone, sub-Saharan Africa, but also in the semi-arid tropics of Asia, Latin America, we see water shortages that affect municipal water consumption, municipal water supplies, but in addition, water that is being used in the agricultural sector for food production and irrigation. We also have a very limited land base for expansion of food production. There is potential to put probably some additional 50 million hectares, not even that, probably 45 million hectares of land under production. But these are in areas that are with poor soils, not easy access, limited access by roads and transport to be able to move input supplies in, take commodities out, and also areas that start to get into very environmentally, ecologically sensitive zones, fragile zones that are prone to ecological problems, loss of biodiversity by moving into this 45 to 50 million hectares of land. But certainly there is some room for expansion to meet some of the food demands. We're also today, as one of the drivers that are challenging us with respect to food production, is the climatic extremes that we face in terms of both drought and excess water. And while at many times we think about the climatic extremes of drought, it's also important for us to note that climatic extremes of floods also severely hamper food production, availability of food, and also limit the food that's available to many of the populations where these floods occur, and not just in North America, but also in parts of Africa, Asia, where we see monsoons, for example, that affect and hurricanes that affect food production. Now, if you think about the land that is available to us for food production, of course, the largest area is the rain-fed producing areas. There's much more rain-fed producing land, something like four times more rain-fed producing lands than irrigated lands. But if you look at some of the projections with respect to climate change and drought that's likely to happen in the future, projections here by UNEP, for example, we'll see that some of the areas that were talked about last night by Stephen McGuirk, particularly in the continent of Africa, is where we will see some of the largest losses in cereal production by the year 2080 as a result of extreme droughts and heat as well that will affect food production. So all of those areas that are shown in orange, yellow, brown, dark red, and dark red being the most significant, where we'll see more than a 50% decrease in cereal production on in Northern Africa, for example, in the Sahelian zone, in the Southern Africa region, and then large parts of India and Asia, where we could see anywhere up to about a 5% decrease in cereal production as a result of increased temperatures and drought. So this really questions how much more can we do on these rain-fed producing lands to be able to meet the food requirements of the future. And this is where irrigation is extremely important. And I think the statistic that we saw last night in Stephen McGurk's presentation, where he said that roughly about 5% of sub-Saharan Africa is irrigated and produces about 20% of the food in that region, is what we also see on a much larger extent globally. Where there are about 1,500 million hectares of cropland globally, about 300 million hectares are irrigated, roughly about 20% of that land is irrigated. And what is important that we should never forget is that that 20% of the global cropland produces 40% of the world's food. So irrigation has an enormous potential. It has played a significant potential in terms of stabilizing food production. It evens out the unevenness we see with respect to these dips in crop production during prolonged dry periods and in the dry season, and irrigation tends to stabilize that production year-round where water is available. So that is also one of the big overriding factors, water availability in those areas to be able to achieve food production. Now, the African continent is endowed with significant water resources. But unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, political, logistical reasons as well, these countries are unable to tap the true irrigation potential, because many of those water supplies on the continent are transboundary waters. We heard last night about Ethiopia and Egypt with the Nile Water Treaty that was developed in 1959 about the sharing of water resources. The same thing happens in many other of the river basins in Africa with respect to the Congo, the Limpopo, for example, in southern Africa. These river basins traverse two or more countries, and therefore you need to have a transboundary agreement to share those water resources, to share the benefits, and also the financing for the construction. And then to get the water from those reservoirs or dams by massive pipelines and canals to the cultivated areas are huge, enormous investments in infrastructure that are required that many governments just don't have the financial capacity to support. So while there is potential to increase irrigation, and certainly there are a lot of efforts to increase irrigation around the world, a lot of it is constrained, as I said, by logistics, by finances, and by political considerations. Now, thinking about this whole area that I mentioned before about the need to increase food production, and we saw the statistics for Asia to be 77%. When we start to look at crop yields, we see a very difficult story that's very worrisome. And this is some work that has been done by Phil Pardee and his colleagues at the University of Minnesota, where they have looked globally at yields of some of the major crops in two periods of time, from 1961 or 1960 to 1990, which was really the period when the Green Revolution took hold. And then between 1990 and the year 2000, and when we start to compare that data by those two time periods, we see some very interesting statistics, some worrisome statistics. And if we take, for example, wheat, one of the major cereals in which, as you know, this year was the 100th anniversary of Dr. Norman Borlaug, the father of the Green Revolution, who played a very critical role to that light blue bar that you see there. The work of Dr. Borlaug and his colleagues at CIMMYT made very significant advances with new high-yielding varieties that showed 2.75% increases in wheat yield, for example. In the last 20 years, we see that those increases are only about 0.5%. And similar trends can be noticed with rice, with maize, the other major cereals that are consumed globally. So one has to wonder how you could achieve those kinds of food demands for the future with these kinds of lower yields. Now, I should mention, these are global yields, so this takes data from, for example, the Midwest United States, where you do have very high yields because of crop genetics, improved technologies, and so on, and it's all lumped together with many parts of the world where those technologies are not available, or even if they are available, are not being used by farmers, which I'll come to later in my presentation. So you lump the good with the bad, and this is what you end up with, a very startling and difficult story. Now, here's some very recent data, originally from the FAO, but also just compiled in a new report by Fisher, Barley, and Edmeads in a very important report, which I would encourage everyone to read, that came out this July with respect to crop yields. And when you look at this chart, you'll see that despite those decreases in yield that I showed you over the past two decades, if you look at the consumption with respect to the food energy that's been taken up in kilocalories per person per day, you'll notice that for all of these major crops, wheat, rice, for example, in the last couple of decades, particularly up until 2007, you'll see that the consumption in terms of those crops, in terms of kilocalories per person, has actually increased. So while we have a decrease in yield, a decrease in productivity, the demand for those crops by the growing population, by a more urban population, is quite significant. But I think what is equally worrisome, which my colleagues from ICRISAT and I worry about quite a bit, you'll see, for example, other cereals, and that includes sorghum, millet, and the pulses, for example, that we work on at ICRISAT. You'll notice that it's a reversed situation, that the energy consumption for those crops, the other cereals and pulse crops, was actually higher in the early decades of the 60s and has actually declined. And that shows several shifts. It shows a shift in terms of people's preference, availability, ease of obtaining it from the market. And earlier this year, the summer, when I was in Zimbabwe as part of a team with ICRISAT, one of the things that was brought home to us by the Minister of Agriculture of Zimbabwe and other parts of sub-Saharan Africa where we visited was the fact that it's now very difficult manually for women in villages to be able to do all the milling and the shelling of things like millet in particular. And so there is this preference by younger women folk to go towards the ease of other crops in terms of market availability, shelling, and so on, for wheat and maize. So these are also not some of the most palatable crops that we're talking about. How do you make them more palatable? And my colleague here, Dr. Shoba, I'm sure will talk to you more during the break about the Smart Foods campaign and so on that ICRISAT is leading to be able to help to increase the palatability, building on the nutritive value of these crops. So there's some very interesting dynamics that one can see from this graph here as we go forward. Now, coming back to this whole situation about the yield, this is some data from one of our fellow CG centers, ICARDA, looking at wheat, primarily in the Middle East and North Africa, where they have run long-term trials at field stations, at ICARDA field stations, at the NARS field stations, and then also from farmers' fields. And you'll notice that under the rain-fed conditions, wheat yields are roughly about 1.8 tons per hectare on average. And when you go up to national yields, which includes some irrigated, better productivity lands, you can get up to about 2.8 tons per hectare. But when we get to irrigated wheat yields, we can get up to about 4.2 tons per hectare. Now, of course, all the CG centers and all the NARs like to work with better farmers to get some of their best benefits to be able to show and to work towards, to advance towards. And so if you take some of these progressive farm yields, elite farmer experimental yields, you can see that we can get as much as about 9 tons per hectare under the most ideal conditions. And so the question is how to go from that 1.8 tons per hectare up to 9 tons per hectare. Now, that's probably unrealistic. Those are very ideal conditions under very well-controlled conditions where you have staff from experimental stations and so on. But how do we at least get up somewhere between the 4.2 and the 6.5 tons per hectare? These are some of the things that we need to address. While this is an example for wheat, it is also the same for rice and maize and other crops as well. So there's quite a bit of room to be able to address some of those challenges. Now, all of these challenges, as you'll see later on, to get there are not technical. And as we heard last night from Stephen McGuirk, there are all kinds of other issues with respect to markets, with respect to infrastructure, government policies, and so on. All those play a part in helping to bring that yield up. So while technically things can be done, we need the enabling or the supporting policy environment for it to take off. Now, in terms of closing the yield gap, there are ways that we can look at this if we break down the different components that affect crop yield. Well, of course, germplasm would be one of the biggest areas, and it's where a lot of the NARs and the CG centers, universities and research centers work in terms of new crop varieties, development of elite cultivars to be able to address those crop traits. But then we have some environmental factors, climatic factors, carbon dioxide, potential increases of CO2 with climate change, radiation, how to best capture the photosynthetic activity radiation, how to better capture the incoming solar energy, make better use of temperatures and water to be able to close that yield gap. And then we have some soil-related factors, nutrients, weeds that need to be controlled as well in terms of improving nutrient capacity, control of weeds, and then pest and disease problems. So these are some of the things that we need to address to be able to close that yield gap. And if we think about the stresses that affect crop productivity, the biotic stresses and the abiotic stresses, then the challenges are how do we develop new cultivars that can handle the pests and diseases as well as sensitivity to water, drought, and heat, increased temperature. And this is where today a lot of the breeding efforts are centered, to be able to develop using new genomics technologies to be able to address the biotic stresses and the abiotic stresses. Given the fact, as I said before, that there is not going to be the ease in which to put a lot of new irrigation systems into place, then we need to have mechanisms to deal with tolerance to drought and water stress. But at the same time, given the fact that the agrochemical industry is about $10 billion a year is spent on agrochemicals, and all of the concerns about human health and environmental health degradation as a result of these high inputs from the agrochemical industry, how can we do more crop breeding to be able to reduce that introduction of high inputs of agrochemicals? And this is where the new genomics platforms are extremely important, to be able to develop platforms that use genomics-assisted breeding, marker-assisted selection, for example, to be able to select traits from ancient cultivars, different cultivars from different regions, to be able to track the kinds of traits that we want from different species to be able to handle the resistance to drought, to heat, and to pest and disease. And building these new high-throughput facilities for genome sequencing, extremely important. I think it is an investment. It's a very significant investment, but one, a multi-million dollar investment that has to be made, and I think is essential for the future of crop production. But at the same time, going with that is all of the bioinformatics facilities that need to be developed to handle the throughput that comes from there, the output that comes from all of these gene sequencing programs, so that we can handle these very large data sets that are being produced to be able to use these big data systems and software and hardware that can do the analysis. As some people would say, it's like searching for a needle in a haystack when you have these terabytes of information and trying to figure out which are the elite genes that you're looking for to be able to put into your breeding programs. Well, we have many successes of our breeding programs to date, as you've seen before with the Green Revolution. But one of the things that I've become quite preoccupied with recently is how do we get these modern varieties to farmers? And earlier this year when I was in Malawi, I saw one of our best success stories of how to get varieties out to farmers. There's a big hurdle in that the CG centers and the NARS can develop cultivars, but if we don't have the national platforms, the national seed tables, as they're called in some countries, to be able to take those varieties, what we call the foundation seed, and be able to replicate that seed into certified seed that other farmers could then use, we have missed the boat. And a lot of it is because we don't have all of the capacity within countries to be able to multiply that seed. And there's sometimes a conflict between the roles of government and the roles of the private sector, especially for the open pollinated varieties. But it's also true to some extent for hybrids as well. So you need to be able to have facilities in countries where the governments and the private sector could work together to be able to take the foundation seed out and have facilities that include good agronomic management, irrigation, water availability to be able to replicate that seed to get it out to farmers. And then what are the organizations downstream of the NARS and the government agencies that are going to take up that seed to get it to the farmers? There's still a lot of logistical hurdles, there's still a lot of territorial protection around IP, and how do you overcome those IP issues? So I'm not going to go through this whole table with you, but I just want to point out a few things. These are some, if you take sub-Saharan Africa, and these have been some of the cultivars that have been released for some of the major crops by the previous decades. And if we take maize, which is one of the biggest success stories, and it's a unique success story, is that you'll notice that improved maize varieties, the numbers increased significantly over the decades, starting with about seven varieties in pre-1970s to today, where there are over 455 new varieties of maize that are released in eastern and southern Africa. And if you go to rice, you'll see a little bit of a different story in that in the 1980s and 1990s, we saw a lot of the release of the new varieties and then starting to taper down. Now, the reason why the maize story is interesting is because of the private sector. It played a very significant role in being able to get those varieties out, to work with the governments to be able to take the varieties out, and also not ignoring the demand and not ignoring the work of some of my colleagues or one of my colleagues in the room who worked on drought-tolerant maize and so on. All of these things had an effect in being able to get varieties out of maize. But not the same situation with many of the other crops. Cassava, a bit of a success story. Beans, again, a commercial crop. from the private sector, but varying degrees of success with the release of these varieties, which shows some of the problems of getting new varieties out. Now, how are those new varieties gotten out? And this is, again, a very recent report from the Independent Science Panel of the CG, and it shows that if you take, for example, again, maize, which has had this bigger success story, you'll see here that in the last 10 years or so, the private sector, as I alluded to before, had a very major role, played a very significant role in getting those varieties out. And compared to the NARS, which is often something that governments don't want to allude to, is the fact that the NARS don't have the capacity. They don't have the trained agronomists, the geneticists, the plant breeders and so on, and also the soil scientists, water scientists, to be able to make use of that technology to get it out. So there's a huge, huge potential to improve the delivery of seed by the NARS if the governments could recognize that they are one of the bottlenecks to get and improve varieties out to farmers. I put this picture up for a couple of reasons. The picture at the bottom is a gentleman, John Breda, in Malawi, who took, he was one of the successes of getting Icrasat groundnut varieties out to farmers. Because the government of Malawi allowed Icrasat to work directly with private farmers to be able to multiply certified seed. And John Breda was able to do this because he made use of very high technology. Helps as well that he was an agricultural engineer, Leroy, so he knew a lot about machinery and irrigation and so on. And he was able to, and also good land, fertile soil, very flat, he was able to be the person that produced about 70 to 75% of the groundnut that Malawi needed, primarily for an export market, because Malawi's production of groundnut, particularly to the UK, was restricted, almost banned, because of aflatoxin. And so where Icrasat made a huge role was being able to develop these varieties of groundnut that were resistant to aflatoxin. But at the top left-hand picture is a field on John Breda's farm. John Breda has, as you can imagine, hundreds of employees working for him, and he gives all of these employees plots of their own. And here's a farmer working on John Breda's farm with a very good field on the bottom right-hand corner, but on the upper left-hand corner, this farmer who's doing something on a private field can't do the same thing on his own field or her own field. And this shows now something psychological that one has to break that barrier. How can that person, how can that farmer do it for a large landowner but can't repeat that technology on his own farm? So these are some of the things that we have to think about. Now, it's not all variety, varietal improvement that one needs to think about. Some other work here by Gibbon et al. Show the impacts of other agronomic practices and the relative yield loss by not paying attention to things like soil fertility, low nitrogen, weeds, striga, late planting and disease, and so on. But the one I want to show you here is nitrogen. And this low input of nitrogen that has caused or causes something over 25% of the reduction in yield. And this is in sub-Saharan Africa, by the way, on maize. So this is another area in which there has been a major underinvestment in agricultural productivity and crop productivity. It is the whole role of soil nutrient availability. Lack of soil testing, lack of laboratory of facilities to analyze soils and to be able to determine nutrient status, and not to mention the cost of imported fertilizers as well. So a lot more to be done in these areas here on this graph to improve crop productivity. Now, one factor that brings crop production with everything else together is the total factor productivity, TFP, And this then looks at all the non-agronomic side of crop production. So availability of research and extension services, availability of credit, institutional support, government policies, markets and prices, physical infrastructure to service the agricultural sector, transportation services, labor availability, and increasingly important, as I showed you on that slide in Malawi with groundnuts, is how do we have the educational services and programs to have skilled people involved in crop production. We put a lot of effort into our university programs, and I'm proud here at McGill that we do a lot in terms of our educational programs for agriculture, right through from our diploma students, two-year diploma program, right through to our PhD students. That same kind of thing, while there are investments, and certainly a lot of agricultural colleges in many parts of the world, in the developing world, a lot more need to be done in terms of educational services and skills training to be able to increase those yields. And some work by Fugli shows here the impact of total factor productivity on global agricultural growth. And what I want you to notice here is how much between 1960 and 1970, in the advent of the Green Revolution, input intensification played in increasing agricultural output, the green part of the bar. So those are all the new high-yielding varieties, the new elite cultivars that came out. Water, fertilizer, pest and disease control all played a major role to boost agricultural productivity quite significantly. But if you notice the time, and it also matches a bit that graph with the decline in yield, you'll see that input intensification went down, but total factor productivity started to play a much greater role in increasing agricultural output. So everything from the non-agricultural side in terms of markets, policies, training, educational effort, infrastructure, those are the things that helped to drive productivity up, but still not to the level where we were in the 1960s to 1990s. And the challenge is now, I think, how do we increase the size of the green on that bar to be able to deal with the inputs, irrigation and so on, to lift this up higher, and but continue what we're doing in total factor productivity. And where this has been most significant, as you can see, in terms of its impact is really in Asia, where you see a combination, East Asia particularly, where you see a combination of input intensification, total factor productivity that has made the biggest change when you look at this data, spatially in terms of increasing agricultural productivity and growth. And certainly in sub-Saharan Africa, while land area expansion played a role in terms of increasing productivity, not to the same level with respect to inputs and total factor productivity, which is where the next set of gains need to be made if we want to lift production. Now let's come to putting all of this together with respect to climate change. And this was something that Peter Cooper out of Nairobi did at one time, when he put together these scenarios of the hypothesis of hope. And case number one is where we are today with these low input practices with the blue bar, and how do we get up to number five in terms of improved practices, improved germplasm under the current climate. And you know, we talk a lot about climate change and the impacts of climate change, but I think what Peter Cooper's model and work did here is to show that we can make even bigger improvements, or just as big improvements, if we paid attention to the improved practices and improved varieties. So this has been backed up by a lot of data that he had collected in Eastern and Southern Africa, and I think drives home the point that while we do worry about climate change and we need to worry about climate change, there are a lot of things we could do with respect to germplasm and also improve practices, as I showed you before, to help to close that yield gap. And not to forget conservation agriculture. I think that is more and more important. especially when we put conservation agriculture in the context of climate change, in the context of greenhouse gas mitigation. How do we sequester carbon in the soil? How do we reduce greenhouse gas emissions? We talk a lot about climate smart agriculture, improve soil productivity, and also to look at conservation agriculture as an integrated system to manage water, soil, carbon, and fertilizer management, I think will become much more important as we go forward. So investments, if we shift a bit to water, certainly investments in water savings technologies have shown that here in Canada, we have today saved 30% water. We use 30% water, less water today than we did 25 years ago, particularly now in the province of Alberta, the largest irrigated province, by making investments in technologies such as you can see here, where we bring the water directly into the canopy of the plant and to the soil rather than spray it on the top and lose water by drift through these low energy precise application methods of irrigation, and also by the work that's been done in Australia, in Victoria, northern Victoria, for example, part of the Murray-Darling Basin, where they have put radial gates, controlled gates, moving from a supply-managed irrigation system to a demand irrigation system, water being available on demand by the farmer rather than being flowing through and wasted downstream. How do we put these control gates connected up to telemetry to release only what the farmer wants in a pre-scheduled application? And Australia had to do this because of the drought, extensive drought that it faced at the start of 2000. And use of sensor technologies becoming more and more important to install sensors that are now becoming much cheaper to be able to measure soil water, couple that to models that we use to be able to precisely define how much water we need and when we need it to better schedule irrigation practices. And today, moving towards technologies such as precision irrigation, variable rate irrigation, to put precisely the amount of water that one needs in different parts of the field based on soil properties and salinity, physical properties as well, including things like undulations to reduce flooding in certain parts of the field. So these are some of the technologies we need to move to in precision irrigation to be able to save water, major benefits in terms of saving water, which we have to do, but at the same time leading to increased crop yields. So Hugo, thank you again very much for the opportunity to speak today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Dean Marramudu, for the very comprehensive and very interesting, stimulating talk. We unfortunately are running a little late in the schedule. I think throughout the day we'll have opportunity to continue the conversation with the Dean and with the other speakers. Certainly we want to have a space where you can present your comments and questions. I don't want to close this first talk without giving one opportunity to anyone to present a question or a comment to Dean Marramudu before we move to the next session. Felix.
Hello, Felix Wangaya, sustainable development journalist. I've stayed very sharply on the irrigation issue because I know that if you read Peter Gleick, we're pretty much at the time of peak water. And certainly the Green Revolution, obviously there were some agricultural improvements in naturally sort of the general agricultural productivity, but irrigation was really the main issue.
Yeah.
And now it seems you've got irrigation problems, as well as we obviously the soil exhaustion, which actually came from that original Green Revolution. Mm-hmm. But I'm just wondering, how are we going to actually address the irrigation? Because we can't keep kind of peaking water. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering what the technological impetus is for example, rain harvesting, drip irrigation, mm-hmm. and also to actually pump and filter that stuff, we probably need to have off-grid energy systems as well. So I'm just wondering if you can address that as sure. succinctly as possible.
Sure. Well, to answer your question, for sure, a lot of potential for rainwater harvesting. One of our colleagues, Suhaswani, does a lot of work on rainwater harvesting. I had a graduate student. It was Jean Labelle's niece, Renaud, who did her master's with me in India on rainwater harvesting and showed the benefits of being able to save as much as 50%, 40 to 50% water through a combination of rainwater harvesting, less groundwater pumping, which is a big problem in many parts of the world, India, especially in the Indo-Gangetic Plain, and at the same time coupling that with drip irrigation systems to be able to save water. So absolutely, you're quite right. Now, in terms of dealing with some of the problems, for sure, we have problems with salinity, we have problems with water logging as a result of excessive irrigation, but we know today what we need to do through things like improved drainage, what we need to do in terms of putting less water on through some of these technologies that I showed you in monitoring soil moisture, instead of just willy-nilly applying water readily, going more to a demand-driven irrigation system rather than our traditional surface supplied systems. We have these technologies. What we need to do now is to exploit those technologies.
Thank you very much again. Thank you for your support. It's my pleasure